From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Leg Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, we talk about the ripple effect on a person's life when facing eviction. Then we hear from the Wisconsin Arts Board about how the arts community is working toward economic recovery from the pandemic.
You know, I think every one of us can't do everything, but every one of us can do something. And, you know, if you stitch together that quilt of somethings, you've got, one hopes, an effective response to the needs of the moment.
Plus, our annual Games to Gift conversation looks at some of the best games of 2020 and how this atypical year has impacted the gaming world.
The biggest trend directly resulting from the pandemic is the movement online for a lot of tabletop gaming. More people are playing role-playing games on Zoom and Roll20 and different tabletop platforms.
Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Leg Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The COVID-19 pandemic has threatened economic stability for many Milwaukeeans. But for renters, there has been some protection. That thin safety net halting some evictions is due to dissolve at the end of the year without congressional action, which means there is a looming eviction crisis hanging over the heads of a lot of Wisconsin households. But there's more to being evicted than just losing your shelter. It's a stain on your rental record that makes it more difficult to find housing again. For families, it can also mean uprooting children from their school system while trying to maintain your dignity. Deb Hefner is the Housing Strategy Director at Community Advocates. She spoke with Lake Effect's Becca Schimmel about what eviction looks like and how it touches every aspect of a person's life.
We're looking at a possible looming eviction crisis in the Milwaukee area and across Wisconsin, across the country. What are the options for people who have been protected by a moratorium but are at risk because of that expiring?
Well, I think it's important to note that, you know, the eviction crisis isn't new. This is something that has been happening now for quite some time. And as a result, Community Advocates and our partners have been really working to be able to address it. Unfortunately, COVID has really taken it into like unprecedented levels. The one positive thing is the amount of support has greatly increased. So if there was a loss of income, we do have rent assistance available still. Community Advocates, we administer the county, the Milwaukee County CARES Act dollars. And the criteria there for rent assistance is just really needing to show that loss of income, and there's specific income eligibility criteria as well. But we are just wanting to make sure that anyone who is afraid of not being able to make their rent is aware that this exists and that they reach out to us. And then beyond that, we, as I just mentioned, have been working to create this Rental Housing Resource Center with a total of 9 partners from all different facets of, housing stability work. And we're trying to be able to help the individual as a whole because there's so many factors that come into play. So in a nutshell, there is help and there is support. So we want to make sure people are aware of that.
Absolutely. And thinking about eviction and the amount of things that it can affect, what are the ripple effects of being evicted?
Well, it's terrible. I mean, there's a lot of obviously health and mental health and physical health ramifications. Just in terms of the stress that happens as a result, there's adverse effects on children. But your home is arguably one of the most important things about someone's life. So if there is a chance that you may not know where you're going to be living, or even just the stress of thinking about that, obviously it's going to affect all facets of your life as well. Those health effects, but then also just the ramification of the eviction itself, because unfortunately it's like just this X on your record that makes it really challenging to be able to get future places. I mean, it's very similar to credit, and it's just unfortunate that often people that are already vulnerable are those who face that. And then it just has this effect, like you said, a ripple effect that just makes it that much more difficult to be able to obtain housing in the future, or quality housing that everybody deserves.
Yeah, of course. And Deb, as you and your colleagues at Community Advocates understand, an eviction crisis isn't always immediately seen or understood by people not directly affected. So from someone working in your field, how would you visualize what eviction looks like in a person's life?
I get emotional thinking about that, you know, and I'm newer to housing as well. But I mean, I think, you know, you can see the pictures, and if you work in the city, it's likely you've even encountered this, like driving, that, you know, you drive past a place where there's just all the belongings that are sitting in front of the home. And if you think about that, you know, and I mean, everybody, like I said, like, you know, housing is such an important part of everyone's world and life. And then, you know, your things are obviously what's in your house. So just to be able to see that, I think it just resonates with the loss, you know, and that this is someone's entire life that's just being completely uprooted. And I think it's important that you know, that people can see that and have empathy towards that, because again, it's something that everyone can relate to. It's their home, you know?
That's a really powerful mental image, that, because I think what makes a house a home, you think about all the ways that you create a home, and seeing that fractured in front of someone's, what was their home?
I think the other thing of it too, is just in talking to tenants, you know, that are on the verge of eviction, it's like this fear that, like, I really haven't encountered before. I mean, because, you know, there's just, it's so urgent. And obviously, like with everything, you know, things take time, assistance takes time. And but for that person, that doesn't matter, because this is their entire life, you know. So it's just that balancing act of realizing that there's so many, you know, emergency situations, but to that person, that is their emergency situation, and making sure that it's, you know, viewed, and that there's just dignity involved in that as well. And I think that's where the Rental Housing Resource Center especially will come into play, because again, it's like the whole gamut of services, and really being able to look at the individual and figure out, like, what is the root of the problem, and be able to help that way.
Well, then I can't help but think about all the other things that are just naturally difficult, say if you're moving to a different place, getting your license and getting all these other things established that you have to have an address for.
Right. So something as simple as that. Yes, exactly. Yeah, I mean, you know, enrolling in school. Like, I mean, I've talked to desperate tenants who are like, I need to get my kids enrolled in school. It's so obviously in the midst of a pandemic, I mean, the fact that these, you know, the majority of children are learning virtually, if you don't have a home right there, you know, that's going to be extremely challenging. And so there's just so many facets in normal everyday life, and then, you know, piled COVID on top of it. And it's just that much more challenging and scary, because obviously there's never been a more important time for someone to maintain stable housing. You know, the other thing I want to mention too, is just, you know, with, you know, I keep talking about the downsides of COVID, but that, like, you know, the upsides are that we really have, in addition to being able to get our Rental Housing Resource Center off the ground, we've been able to talk to so many landlords. And I think, you know, we've always taken the approach of, like, we have to work together. It's not adversarial, you know, our relationships, but it's just been able to provide new opportunities to communicate and, you know, come around the same table. And so much of it is just about education. And, like, you know, you just, that question you asked me was just so important about how someone that maybe not has experienced this can really see what it's like, and just being able to, you know, come around the table and just share, like, the version of, like, what we're seeing, and then, you know, find common ground. And there's exceptions to every rule, but the majority of landlords that we work with do want to be able to try and as well keep the tenant in the house. I mean, it's obviously advantageous to them as well. I mean, it's very costly to even file an eviction.
Yeah, I think a lot of people are experiencing and understanding how close someone can be to losing their housing than ever before. Do you feel like one of the other bright spots of COVID might be that the work that you all are doing, the challenges that you see every day in the community, are being seen by more people?
That's a really good point too. Yes, absolutely. And really, like, even thanks to, like, media, I feel like it's just been covered so much more. We're able to get the information out about the resources. a lot of people have read the book Evicted by Matt Desmond. And if you have not and you're listening, you should definitely read it to help understand the eviction crisis better. And what's interesting about that book is that it also takes place in Milwaukee. And they Matt Desmond actually worked with community advocates, you know, as he wrote that book. But, you know, Evicted was like great in terms of being able to also like capture more interest and just be able to depict it. And then again, since COVID, I think there's just been a stronger focus on getting out the information on resources and just more awareness raising to not only the crisis, but the resources that exist to help the crisis.
The immediate challenge someone faces when being evicted is housing. Where are they going to find shelter? But what are the other somewhat unknown difficulties that eviction presents?
In terms of, you know, we're not knowing where you're going to go that night is obviously like the big pressing issue. But, you know, if you do have things and, you know, if they do get put on the street, like, you know, we have like a triage mechanism where we're thinking like, okay, so first of all, let's make sure that the person has a place to go that night, but then also that they have a place to take their things to, you know, and often those things are costly, though, too, like to be able to move things or if you don't have a vehicle. So it's just like working on those like logistics. But like safety, obviously, is the first huge part of it, and dignity as well, because like, you know, going back to that whole these are personal things and they're value, you know, they're valuable. So so that and then beyond that, you know, focusing on a longer term solution. So oftentimes if someone has to move, obviously, it's going to be a quick move to something temporary. And so then we're going to try and work to figure out a relocation plan. And that's another, I think, thing of, you know, of COVID too, is that, you know, working to build more relationships with landlords and having like an increased willingness to possibly even rent to someone that has a past eviction, you know, on their record. But so relocating to a longer term thing, because the ultimate goal then is just to make sure that that person does have safe and stable housing.
How do you work to help someone who feels that they've lost their dignity because of a housing issue, because of being evicted?
Yeah, I mean, I think regaining housing is, you know, is very important, and also just having like compassion and empathy. And I think, you know, it's very important to the way that we deliver our services that everyone that we're working with understands that, you know, they're not alone. I mean, I've actually heard, it's interesting because, you know, people say, I'm not a bad person. I'm like, I know you're not a bad person. I mean, you can have like, you know, you can be making, you know, a pretty decent salary and something can happen and it can spiral. I mean, COVID's been an example of that too, you know? So, and unfortunately, you know, people of color are often disproportionately affected by this, and women as well. And it's, you know, just important for people to be aware that, you know, this is not exclusive to them and that there's systematic issues involved as well. I think that hopefully helps as well. And just advocating, I think, for change, you know, on a policy level too is important, because, you know, you can help the individual, but there's obviously things that need to be changed, you know, policy-wise that could make, a difference for the broader population.
What are your concerns for what happens if the eviction moratorium ends as it is scheduled to do?
Well, so, and that's an interesting one. So the eviction moratorium, you know, first it was the statewide one. Currently we have the CDC federal moratorium. It is good in the short term, you know, in terms of helping us to be able to keep, you know, tenants like stable in the moment. But unfortunately, it's not a rent freeze. And, you know, it has a trickle effect. Like if a tenant's not able to pay their rent, the landlord is not able to pay their mortgage. And it's like, it's kind of like the food chain, you know, it goes. And so I think it's, you know, really important to us to make sure that that people know that the resources exist, because rent assistance, really the level that we have right now can help to cure that arrear and make it so that, you know, they're once again in good standing, because unfortunately come January, that rent is still going to be owed. You know, as we all know, Wisconsin's the coldest, January is the coldest month of the year in Wisconsin. So it's just going to be that much scarier knowing that that many people are in jeopardy of possibly losing their homes. So I think it's just more about getting the message out that, you know, this is not a rent freeze, and that, you know, just to seek help and resources, and do not be ashamed or embarrassed anytime, but especially not during this time, because, you know, this is why we exist, is to be able to try and help. And there's, you know, never been a more important time for us to be there.
And is the city of Milwaukee prepared for what could be a looming eviction crisis?
I don't think any city is prepared for what could be a looming eviction crisis. I mean, obviously shelters are filled, and, you know, I think that going back to, again, just to being, you know, Wisconsin and winter. And so I think it's scary. And I think, you know, hopefully there'll be, you know, another stimulus package that is passed that would bring in more increased resources. And we're so grateful to, you know, the county and the city of Milwaukee and the state that, you know, stepped up and you know, utilized their CARES dollars to be able to put towards rent assistance, because it really has been able to make the difference in this current moment. So it's really thinking about moving past January. And so, like, all fingers are crossed. But there's this private, you know, because obviously not everybody is eligible for the you know, the federal dollars. So the other thing is, like, the philanthropy community, you know, has definitely stepped up. And you know, and so that, in that way, that's another positive, because the tension is there, and we've just been able to work with each other, and we're so grateful to be able to have these resources, because we obviously get to see the positive effects of being able to help that, you know, that person.
Deb Hefner is the Housing Strategy Director at Community Advocates. She spoke with Lakefek's Becca Schimmel about eviction and the ripple effects it has. We'll take a break and then hear from the Wisconsin Arts Board about what artists need to recover economically. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Artists across Milwaukee have seen their workplaces close and typical revenue-generating streams dry up because of the pandemic. While bars and restaurants have continued to be open, venues have stayed closed. The needs of artists and small businesses are growing the longer the pandemic stretches on. A virtual town hall was held on Tuesday in hopes of working to address some of the challenges Wisconsin creatives are facing. George Sugros is the executive director of the Wisconsin Arts Board. He spoke with Lake Effect's Becca Schimmel on Wednesday about the town hall and what artists say they need to recover.
Being able to connect with one another, I think one of the things we're always happy with and surprised by at the same time is how important it is for people just to connect with one another. And to hear they're not alone, and to hear what they're struggling through is not just what they're struggling through, but what their, you know, their peers are struggling through as well. And so the next step is also to get the 15 organizations to figure out what pieces of help they can provide. You know, I think every one of us can't do everything, but every one of us can do something. And, you know, if you stitch together that quilt of somethings, you've got one hopes. An effective response to the needs of the moment. And I think one of the other things that was reminded yesterday was that, yes, these are the needs of the moment, but some of the inequities predate COVID and the pandemic. And so it's a reminder that whatever you do to help, you remember that those inequities exist or existed prior to all of this.
What does the Wisconsin arts community need in order to recover from the economic challenges it is facing due to the COVID-19 pandemic?
Well, and it runs the gamut, right? So yesterday we heard from artists, but the arts organizations as well are suffering. And we heard some of that yesterday as well. First of all, first and foremost, things are not open, right? So museums are not open, performing arts facilities are not open, due to public health issues. But in addition to whatever earned income would come from ticket sales, the ongoing connection to patrons is not the same as it would be if these groups were open. And then, of course, as was talked about, there's the question is, okay, we're closed, but other groups are open. So why are they able to be open and our organizations are to be closed? Especially in Milwaukee, where it's been really set out that performing arts organizations for sure have to remain closed. So there's the dollars that have evaporated from being closed, the concern for contributed income, and will patrons remain patrons during this time when they can't be part of the organization physically, which is why many have pivoted to the internet and tried to maintain that connection. And then just the idea that these organizations are losing their staffs, right? And so how are they able to support the staffs? It's not just not that they're closed, but they have these wonderful creative people that they want to keep, but what can they do in the interim? A, to raise the money to keep them, and B, to keep them working and doing great stuff.
It has to be hard seeing other places in Milwaukee and throughout Wisconsin being able to open while a lot of arts venues and artists are still not able to work.
Yeah, right. And as we talked about yesterday, in the case of the artists, they, if their primary income was as an artist, they may have other gigs as well. They may have been teaching classes, or they may have been working in the hospitality industry. So all of their gigs have evaporated because of COVID, right? So that makes it really difficult. It's one thing to lose a job. In this case, they may have lost multiple jobs. But there is always the need to create as well and to maintain the marketplace. So it's the individual artists, it's their galleries, it's all of that.
And George, the organization that you're executive director for, the Wisconsin Arts Board, recently joined others in the town hall, as you mentioned, to address a number of issues in the community moving forward. One of those was racial equity and social justice. So how do you plan to work toward these goals in the next year?
Well, first and foremost, we work with people, right? So we're not going to do anything for anybody, but we're going to work with people to really suss out the need and then figure out how we can meet that need in cooperation with the different parts of the community. So part of it is addressing the realities of our budget and where those dollars have been. Some of that has happened already in our ability to give grants with the CARES Act funding that we received from the National Endowment for the Arts. And that was very specifically arts organization funding. And then, of course, the state of Wisconsin put forward $15 million for CARES Act funding for arts organizations. In addition, they put forward $10 million for movie theaters and $15 million for performing arts venues, so live performance venues. So $40 million towards the creative economy in the state of Wisconsin. And what's been really interesting to watch is to see how artists have been acknowledged as sole proprietors as businesses, maybe for the first time. And so the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation's We're All In grants have been made available to artists should they have decided to apply. And so it's wonderful to see then acknowledgement of what is has been always the reality, that artists are small business people and they're doing their work, and now see support even beyond the Arts Board in state government.
Sounds like there are some permanent changes that really may help moving forward in the future when the pandemic is behind us as well, with that sole proprietorship.
Yeah. I mean, I like I say, I think it's really important that those groups are, those artists are acknowledged as business people, because it's not only a change of perception from the state level, but it's, in some ways it's a change of perception for some artists to say, wait a minute, that's right. We are in fact small business people. And we do deserve support just like every other small business person. So,
how has the community's interest and reliance on art changed during the pandemic? What have you noticed?
Well, I think, first of all, the community's reliance on art is greater than it's ever been. Meaning, how do you make it through sheltering at home without books and music and films and all of the art forms that you need as a consumer? So somebody who's reading all those things, or maybe you're writing for the first time in ages because you've got the time to do that, or you've picked up an instrument that you set aside for years, and now you're able to pick it up and play it again. So the arts themselves have been fundamental to people's navigating through and coping with all the isolation that's been going on. And then, as I said before, artists and arts organizations have pivoted to the internet to provide, whether it's art fairs on the internet, you know, so people get a chance to see Wisconsin artists' work there, or the great theater productions that are going on in the state, everywhere from Milwaukee Rep to the American Players Theater, all online and accessible to people in that way. And I think what's interesting about all of that is it is accessible to folks who may not have, even in a normal situation, been able to get out to the theater. And so as we look at the future, we're going to see this moment as an opportunity to do both and, right? So when we're finally able to get back into the theater and see a show, we're going to be able to do that. But for those who can't, we will have had this experience to make it accessible to them as well. And I think that's, if we're looking for a bright spot in COVID, that may be one of them.
How has Milwaukee's arts community met the changing or even increased needs across the state?
Yeah, well, I think, again, the internet provides that opportunity to bring Milwaukee arts outside of Milwaukee. And, you know, taking the Christmas Carol live streams that the Rep is doing, you don't have to be in Milwaukee. You don't have to travel to Milwaukee to take advantage of that opportunity to have your holiday season brightened a bit with that. And I think all of the other groups that have put themselves out there, you know, if I get to hear, for example, the virtual orchestra that the Milwaukee Symphony did at the early part of the pandemic, it may be the first time that I, in somewhere else in Wisconsin, get to hear them play and might be intrigued to see more of what they have and follow their recordings and see when they're going to come back to the hall and, you know, and see the videos about the new hall and get excited about when that might open. So there is all of that. And then, of course, there's art that's created specifically for the internet. You know, artists who are working in the media arts that are using that that form as well. So it's everything, every type of art, and the traditional arts as well. You know, people who are using their background, their cultures, to bring forward expressions of material and expressive culture, and doing that via the internet as well. Perfect example there is the National Endowment for the Arts. We have in Wisconsin, I don't know if you know this, we have two 2020 National Heritage Award winners from Wisconsin. And so both of them are on the National Endowment's website in interviews, and you can see their work, et cetera. So lifting up and interview these really great traditional artists. So again, another opportunity that people may not know about.
Are there other needs or things you're paying particularly close attention to in the arts community that you think are important to note or talk about?
We're looking at the issue of the distribution of funds. We're always looking at the celebration of the different cultures of our state and the equity in their support and expression. And helping to connect people to one another to help bring those expressions to the public in one way or another, whether that's an exhibition or a performance. Or like yesterday, one of the things that's come out of COVID is the plethora of murals that have been created, the sense of place that's created with all of these murals that are going up across the state. And one of the questions yesterday was, hey, we're really into this mural thing, but we need help. We don't really understand how to do this and how to do it at the scale that we're doing it already. And so even within the context of that meeting yesterday, people started reaching out to one another to provide that sort of peer-to-peer assistance. So yeah, money, equity, inclusion, and the one other thing I think that we're really focused on is helping people reopen, right? Because as theaters reopen, as museums reopen, there's the personal protective equipment that's necessary. There's traffic patterns that are going to change and which ways you can go. There's capacity issues for performing arts spaces. How many people can sit in your theater and how close can they be to one another? And then Wisconsin Public Radio did a story on an artist in Appleton who's creating masks for musicians. So the innovation to get people playing again, that's going to help us reopen if you can, in fact, use these masks to mitigate the spread of COVID. So there's all that kind of innovation out there as well. But really, the reopening is the issue at hand, and making sure people have access to the best ideas that are coming, not only from the arts, because national arts organizations are really pursuing this, but also from other industries as well.
George Sugros is the executive director of the Wisconsin Arts Board. He spoke with Lake Fex Becca Schimmel about what artists and venues need to recover from the economic challenges of COVID-19. We'll take one more break and then return with our annual Games to Gift segment. That's when Lake Fex returns in just a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The holiday season is in full swing, and many of us are already trying to figure out what to buy our loved ones. And although many of us will be avoiding extended family gatherings this year, there are still ways to stay connected, and gaming is one of them. Every year, gaming expert James Lauder gives us his picks for the best games to gift. He joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers to talk about the top games of the year.
2020 has been such an atypical year, and for many of us, it's been a particularly lonely year since safe social gatherings are really limited by the pandemic. How has that impacted the gaming world, and what are some of the trends you've seen come out over this past year?
Well, the biggest trend directly resulting from the pandemic is the movement online for a lot of tabletop gaming. More people are playing role-playing games on Zoom and Roll20 and different tabletop platforms. Game companies are accelerating the use of online tools for people to build communities. And then there are games like Pursue the Pennant, the old stat-based baseball game developed in Brookfield, Wisconsin by Mike Sizlinski. They have moved almost entirely online, but the game has been developed so that you can play with the old tabletop boards as well. So that's been a big movement in the last year to compensate for and allow people to continue building their communities, even though the pandemic has isolated everybody.
You've split up the different kinds of games that we're going to talk about into their own categories. So let's start here with something that a lot of us can still do in person, two-player games.
Yes, we normally do party games. We left that out this year. So I offered a couple of two-player games instead. The first one is Nunami, and that's a really interesting design put together by three generations of an Inuit family. And it is a terrain management game played on 6 or 10 hexagonal boards. You use numbered cards. One player plays nature, one player plays humans. And you fill in the terrain hexagons, and then when they're completely filled with cards, you score them. And depending on who has majority control or who has the most points, players get a victory point. And the first player to 4 points, 4 victory points wins. The thing that's great about it is this is sort of an abstract game, but it's also got an ethos. The idea is that if either the human player or the player controlling nature pushes a hexagon too far in one direction, if it gets too developed with humans, if it gets too wild with nature, bad things can happen to that player and they can lose a lot of points, lose a lot of cards that go out of play because you have unbalanced the Arctic ecosphere.
The second one is a game that I think a lot of people are already going to be familiar with, but can be played with two players.
Yes, Magic the Gathering is the famous trading card game created by Richard Garfield in 1993. In it, each player is a planeswalker. You're a wizard who has monsters and spells and various artifacts under your control, and that's represented in the cards, and the two players battle it out using the cards. The Arena Starter Kit that they released this year is very interesting because it actually dovetails with the Magic online presence at the online arena. So you get a code when you get the cards that you can replicate your deck online. You can play in person with the physical cards. You can play online through the arena with the digital cards. They've been doing starter sets for Magic the Gathering steadily over the years since 93. This is the first one where they've put a lot of effort into linking it up with the online presence. And that's great at this point. You can get tired of playing the same battle against the same person. This gives you a lot of other options. The other thing they did, if you know Magic well and you don't need the starter deck, the other thing they've done this year to speed up the game and make it a little more interesting is the Jumpstart Kits, which are two half decks that you combine to a full combat deck. And they mash things up so you can have a deck that's all cats and pirates or things like that. And it's built for speedier play. And Magic as a hobby game, people develop these killer decks that they build over years, and it's impossible to defeat them because they've put all this time into it. If you go with these preformed decks, it speeds the game up and it adds a little more variety if you're playing in a tight group.
So for people who have more than two people who they want to play with and can play with, you have a whole category of family games. What are some good games to gift this year in that category?
Family games are always great because the way I define them, the way they're generally looked at, are games that can play with a range of people, usually older kids, 8 to 10, 10 to 12, and then adults. And these are games that will engage everybody at the table. The parents won't get frustrated playing because the games are too simple. The kids won't be bored because the games are too long. The first one I mentioned is a game called Isle of Cats, which is published by City of Games. It's for 1 to 4 players, 8 and up. And you're citizens of Squall's End, and you are on a mission to the Isle of Cats to rescue as many cats in 5 turns as you can, before the evil Lord Besh arrives and ends the game. The cats are sort of like oddly shaped dominoes, and being cats, of course, they are oddly shaped. And you've got to collect as many as you can and fit them onto the deck of your ship, which is gridded out. And you need to cover up certain rooms, and you need to cover up all of the ship's rats, or you lose points. And the cats, of course, don't necessarily cooperate because of shape here. You want to group them together in families. It's played over, like I said, 5 turns. It's very fast to play. It's got a solo mode. It's also got a family mode, as well as a hobby mode. The hobby mode, you do a little more resource management. The family mode simplifies the game a little bit. So if you're playing with younger kids, it plays faster and requires a few less decisions each turn. If Isle of Cats is difficult to come by this season, and that is something that everybody should be aware of going into the game store or dealing with the local stores online. The distribution networks have been really a mess this year. And so games can be hard to come by. Always go in with options. Don't focus too hard on one game that you were hoping to pick up. Look around a bit. The older list that we put together for the games to gift segments are always good sources there. Several of them are up on the Lake Effect website. In the case of Isle of Cats, there's another game, Calico, where you are putting together quilts and trying to attract cats to fit on the quilts. That's another really, really nice game that kind of fills the same slot in the family game market. The second game this year is Cartographers, which is for ages 10 and up. Players, they list 1 to 99 based on the number of sheets available in the box, but really you want to probably play with 1 to 6. Players are cartographers sent to map the new northern kingdoms, the new northern lands by the queen. She has specific features that she wants to see in her new kingdom, which are noted in edict cards that all the players can see. You explore the new territory by flipping over cards, which will describe shapes that you need to draw into your map and then the terrain that you need to draw in with it. And each player can, based on the cards, usually choose one of two different things to put together, and they get to choose where the shapes go. So everybody's maps are completely different. You score based on those edict cards and some other things, like you may turn over a monster ambush. And when that happens, everybody switches maps and your rivals get to draw the monster ambush in on your map. And then you have to make sure you fill in around that or you lose points. So it's got that nice interactive aspect to it as well. It plays in, about half an hour, a little longer. And it's got that really nice art component to it as well. So that's a game that'll work for both adults and kids. And then the third game that is an old-fashioned City Monster Stomp. It's the Godzilla Tokyo Clash game from Funko. It's 2 to 4 players, 10 and up. That plays with 2 players just fine. It doubles as a 2-player game. You set up the city based on different event cards, and then you have these really nicely sculpted little plastic miniatures of Godzilla, Mothra, King Ghidorah, and Megalon, the giant cockroach. And you go around stomping the city to gather energy and battling the other monsters. That's just a good clash game, sort of like the board game King of Tokyo, King of New York, which we've mentioned here. And that one's a lot of fun, especially if you are a fan of the Godzilla movie series, or you've got kids that are fans of the Godzilla movie series. It's got lots of references to the old Toho films in the cards and the setup.
If you're just tuning in, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers, and I'm speaking with James Lauder. He is the executive editor for Chaosium, and we're talking about the best games to gift this year. Now, these family games are really for the whole family, for adults, for kids. But if you're specifically playing with kids or for games that would be played just by kids, what are some good options?
Kids games are always tough, and the one thing to always keep in mind with kids games is that the rules can always be changed. When you pick up a game and you start playing, the rules can be changed to fit your family and fit your kids. Rules are not mandates, they are suggestions. So one of the games that has been out in the last couple of years is Wobble King, and this is a little bit of a throwback to the old Ideal games like Don't Break the Ice and things like that. It's partly physical challenge, where you've got King Leo balanced atop a board, which is balanced atop some silver nuggets, little pieces of wood that are representing silver nuggets. And you use a stick to slide some of the nuggets out from under the board. But if you take too many out, King Leo tips and the whole board tips down, and King Leo throws a tomato at you and you get a little tomato token. And the first person to get 2 tomato tokens loses. Everybody else wins. You know, if that's frustrating for your kids, you can come up with different victory conditions or co-op conditions. But it's a cleverly designed game, and it's a fun little balancing game and plays for kids as young as 4. Another game, and this is a good one to consider during the pandemic, is the Color Monster, the board game based on the best-selling kids' books. And this is a cooperative game in which the players move the monster around the board where he lands on spaces that have colored emotion tokens. And to pick up one of the tokens that represent happiness, sadness, anger, fear, the player has to describe a time they felt that emotion. Then they can pick up the emotion token. And what they try to do is put it in the correct jar. And this is, they're all color-coded. The jar colors are hidden. So there's a bit of a memory aspect to this as well. And the players win when they get all of the emotion tokens correctly sorted in all of the jars. And for kids that have been dealing with the pandemic, this is a great platform to be talking about feelings they may be dealing with. That's something that games can do as well.
Moving from games for younger players to really games for people who are in the know, hobby games. First of all, how would you describe these kinds of games, and what are your top picks for this year?
So hobby games differ from kids games in that they tend to be for 12 or 14 and up. They differ from family games in that these are games that invite a depth of play. Family games tend to be playing a half an hour to an hour. They're very satisfying. They can have strategy to them, but it's not a game that necessarily invites a deep focus like chess or Magic the Gathering, because there are so many cards and so many different combinations that you can work out that invites a deep level of play. So a good hobby game will do that. And this year, there have been a number of great ones. There has been a ton of innovation in hobby games, especially where they use mechanics that are intriguing. There's a role-playing game out this year that is a vinyl album. The vinyl album jacket is the GM screen. The game itself is played by interacting with the sounds on the album. That's sold out. I would have mentioned it as a pick this year. But the games that I did mention, the first one is Gloomhaven, Jaws of the Lion. And that is a prequel to the even more weighty and even more daunting Gloomhaven fantasy role-playing dungeon crawl where you're moving through the city, fighting your way through the goals. Jaws of the Lion takes a mercenary troop and simplifies the rules, quickens up the playtime. And one of the things about Gloomhaven, the main game is the tile laying for the board as you're setting up the game can be pretty time consuming. But the Jaws of the Lion gets around that by having the scenario booklet actually double as the play area as well. So as you open up, turn to new pages for the scenarios, that's the board that you're contending with. It's a very clever way to get around that time consuming issue. But it plays in 25 different scenarios where you are trying to uncover the mysteries surrounding some disappearances in the city. It introduces four new fantasy characters that you can actually move into the main Gloomhaven game. This stands alone, but it's got a lot of replayability because of the extra scenarios, and it could be a gateway into the larger Gloomhaven game series. Mariposas is the new design from Elizabeth Hargrave, who had last year's Games to Give top pick, Wingspan. This year, she is taking on the theme of monarch butterfly migration and life cycle, which is, as with Wingspan, not something you would necessarily think of as a big board game topic. She does a magnificent job with this as well, as she did with Wingspan and birding. This one, you play over three seasons where you are following the migration of the monarchs to the north. They spread out, they gather up and head back south. You are trying to control movement using cards and collect sets for life cycles. The game itself is relatively simple. It's largely that movement and set collection, but there are a number of things about the cards and other tokens you can encounter that add a lot of strategy to this, and it invites just repeated deep play. This is a game that you'll get into pretty easily initially and then will play repeatedly because there's a lot here. There's a lot of different strategies that you could uncover. And then Imperial Struggle is on the surface, a classic, gigantic, long 2 to 4 hour war game. In this case, you're playing either two players. You are playing France or England in the 18th century scramble to divide up the world and establish empire. It is by Ananda Gupta and Jason Matthews, who designed the classic Cold War war game Twilight Struggle back in 2005. And this uses some of the same mechanics. It's developed from that engine. It's not the same game. And it is a very sophisticated, long, slog war game. One of the things that's really interesting about it is older games that handle topics like this tended to gloss over the history. So when you are looking at the conflict between the empires, the negative things that happened in history, the ugliness of imperialism would have been in an old Avalon Hill game generally, not something that the cards covered. They're covered directly in here. So you contend with slavery, you contend with oppression of the local populations. Even when you are working to do things in your peace phases, you are essentially working toward war. And so that makes it a really interesting way to deal with the historical realities of imperialism. It's designed primarily not as a historical teaching tool. It's designed as a good war game, but it's got that aspect to it as well that's going to invite some serious consideration of what kind of things that you do to win the game.
Well, this next category of games is often a subset of hobby games, RPGs, also known as role-playing games. For the uninitiated, role-playing games are essentially when the players take on a kind of character in the realm of the game. What are some of the top picks for this year?
This year, the two role-playing games I specifically picked, one is the Alien role-playing game from Free League, a Swedish game company that has sort of burst onto the scene recently. They've done several just amazing graphically designed role-playing games. Their game Tales from the Loop was adapted as an Amazon miniseries, so people might have seen some of their content through that. The Alien role-playing game is tied in with the movie franchise. You play space marines or space truckers who are contending with the aliens throughout science fiction. It's based on the same Year Zero game engine that their other games have been using. It's essentially a really great dark fantasy horror science fiction. They also released, and I list the main game here, it's a $50 hardcover, gives you everything you need to develop characters and play the game. They also released a starter set for the game. That's a big trend in role-playing games now. Different companies releasing starter sets. I mentioned three last year. There are others this year, Pathfinder and Starfinder from Paizo, both had great starter sets as well. All of those, if you're looking for gateways into role-playing games, all of those are fantastic options. For Aliens, either one will work. If you're looking for a way to introduce yourself to role-playing games, the Alien starter set is great. But the main role-playing game, if you're a little familiar with role-playing games, is a fantastic book. The Fiasco box set is sort of the other end of role-playing games. It's also a starter box, but Fiasco is a role-playing game. Well, it's not as far as you can possibly go, but it's pretty far along the spectrum away from the heavy, here's a $50 hardcover with tons of rules and lots of character generation and things like that. Fiasco plays as a role-playing game. It's sort of one part role-playing game, one part party game, and one part improv troop exercise. Using cards, you go through two acts describing something that went spectacularly wrong for the characters that the people at the table are playing. And the games play in a very short amount of time. You can play through a scenario in about half an hour. And it's designed to basically be a really fun, fast pickup that introduces the idea of role-playing, that this is your character and using cards and then interacting with the other players at the table, you determine how the story is unfolding for that character. One of the things that I really love about the Fiasco system, especially with the box set, is they have the Let's Not card, which is put out on the table. And if the story is going in a way that makes one of the players uncomfortable, you tap the Let's Not card and everybody rewinds and you go back and take the story in a different direction. Because gaming, especially role-playing games, it's important to have everybody comfortable at the table and everybody having fun. That's a marvelous mechanic. And Jason Morningstar, who's the main designer for Fiasco, he also contributed to the book that I'm recommending this year that just came out from Adams Media, the Ultimate Micro RPG book, which includes 40 different basic role-playing games that you can play. So if you're looking for just a real fast role-playing game that you can play with whoever's around, that's a great resource. It's a trade paperback, $15, lots of play value, and it can be a great gateway into role-playing game as a hobby.
Well, and another kind of gateway are these smaller games that you can really put as a stocking stuffer. What are your suggestions for those?
For stocking stuffers, I always try to pick games that are, you know, affordably priced, $10 or $15, especially with card games. And both of the choices this year are card games. That's usually possible. And as with the other types of tabletop games being produced, there's lots of innovations and lots of amazing designs that are coming out with these just simple, small box card games. One is The Mind Extreme, which is an expansion upon the card game The Mind. And The Mind is played, it's a silent cooperative game, which is kind of amazing just in itself that somebody came up with that. So each player is in the base game, The Mind. You have cards numbered between 1 and 100, and each player is supposed to play the cards in order from lowest to highest, but you have to do so without talking. So you figure out after you play this game a few times, I mean, it sounds impossible, but you figure out just through body language and things like that, how the groups that you play with will play the game so that you actually can beat the game at different levels. And the number of levels in the game determines the number of cards you have in your hand. So first level, everybody has one card. Second level, everybody has two cards. The Mind Extreme takes that and makes it tougher. It divides that 1 through 100 deck into two decks of 1 through 50. One group of cards needs to be played in ascending order. One group of cards needs to be played in descending order. And depending on what level you're playing, some of them are played blind. So you put the cards down, face down, and only after the turn is over do you determine whether or not you actually succeeded. It's an amazing concept that actually works, and it's a game that has a lot of replay value because each turn plays really fast. And if you fail, you'll see the group change their dynamics and change their behavior to make this work. And this is all in a game that's, you know, like $13, a little deck of cards. It's fantastic. The other stocking stuffer game I mentioned this time is Animix. It's a marvelous design. This one for ages 8 and up, 2 to 6 players. There are different suits of animals. Each one of them has a different scoring condition. And each time you can play with different animals in play. And each one of them, depending on the mix of animals in the game, will change how things play out. So this has got a lot of replayability to it. You lay out some of the animals on a grid. You have others in your hand. You take turns either taking a card from your hand and adding that to your scoring pile, or taking a card from your hand and replacing one of the cards on the grid and scoring that. And then the score is determined by how the animals are arrayed on the grid. So each one of the different kinds of animals are scored depending on monkeys have to be in a vertical column, elephants have to be in a horizontal line, and that determines how many points elephants are worth. And then if you've got the most elephants in your hand, you score that number of points. It's a great design, and again, another really, really fast play, and it's a game that works great for kids and adults.
If you're just tuning in, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers, and I'm speaking with James Lauder. He is the executive editor for Chaosium, and we're talking about the best games to gift this year. Now, for, I guess, what you'd call the piece de resistance, what is your top game to gift for 2020?
Well, there was some temptation this year to pick one of the pandemic games. They're all marvelous. And we've mentioned them on the show in past years. If you are not pandemicked out, by all means, go and look some of those up. They're co-op games where you are defeating the pandemic, which can have some emotional satisfaction at this point. The game that I did decide to pick for the top game this year was the new release of the Dune board game, originally published in 1979 by Avalon Hill. And it's very unusual to see a licensed game like this. It's tied in with the Frank Herbert science fiction novel. It's very unusual to see one of those get re-released, but because the new movie is coming out, the Gale Force 9 got the rights to re-release this game and actually brought back the original design team to put a newer edition together that streamlined some of the rules and fine-tuned things. It was a brilliant game to start with. This version of the game is even better. You are playing one of 6 factions who are vying for control of the planet Arrakis, or the planet Dune, and the flow of the spice melange on the world. It's an asymmetrical game where each one of the factions has different strengths and powers. There is negotiation, there is alliances, there's area control. It's got a lot going on. It's a lot of fun. It plays in about 2 hours. This leans toward the hobby game more than a family game, but I'm such a fan of this that I really felt like I had to include it. This is another one, another example of a game that may be a little hard to come by. It came out at the end of last year. It's a little spotty in distribution right now, but if you can't get it at the holidays, keep an eye out for it. Interestingly enough, there's another Dune board game, Dune Imperium, out that's being marketed a little more directly with the movie, and that's also marvelous. I prefer the Gale Force 9 game, which is built off of the Cosmic Encounter engine that the same designers did. Cosmic Encounter is more of a family game version of this, but the Dune board game is a gem.
We've talked a lot about how 2020 has been a really difficult year. What is your advice to people who are interested in gaming and hoping to find some of these games?
Well, all of the local game stores, and Milwaukee is very fortunate. We have a number of excellent, excellent game stores and hobby game stores and comic book stores that also carry hobby games in this area. The game stores are all willing to do orders for you. If you want a special order game, this is a great time to support local businesses. If you want to special order a game, contact them as early as possible, either through, best is usually the website or their Facebook page. After that, you can try calling. They are all happy to do special orders, or they can tell you whether they have a game in stock. And if you give them extra time, because the distribution channels are unreliable this year, that they may need extra time. Have other options in place. You can also talk to them about other games that they may recommend. All of them have people working there who are hobbyists, who are game enthusiasts, and they are generally happy to share the games that they love with you. The other aspect of that is all the local stores are willing to do curbside pickup. They're all trying to act responsibly. They are doing a great job with that from the stores that I've talked to about how they're handling policy at this point for the holidays. That would be a really terrific way for you to support local businesses, is reach out to those local game stores and give them your support.
All right. Well, James Lauder, thank you so much for joining us once again with your best games to gift, and have a happy new year.
Oh, you too, and a better 2021 for everyone.
Gaming expert James Lauder is the executive editor of Chaosium, and he joins us every year to talk about the best games to gift for this holiday season. He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers, and you can find their full conversation with all of Lauder's recommendations at WUWM.com. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and please join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.